we tried loads, loads and loads over the years to, like, you know, get more sales in. You know, what can we do to kind of increase the demand, make them move quicker? And this was a strategy for us to acquire 30 customers overnight.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. Each week, I sit down with world-class founders and figure out the secrets and systems they use to build their business, their body, and their brain. This week, chatting to Nick Keegan, founder of Mail Metrics. He is a finalist in this year's Entrepreneur of the Year by EY. He is an incredible character. This is a true entrepreneur story. For 3 years, he struggled to find traction with his business. And then suddenly, a little tweak, and he found product market fit. This is a masterclass in building an early stage business because Nick is brutally honest about every mistake he made and now the playbook he has discovered. First, to get traction, and secondly, now the playbook he's building his business rapidly through the power of acquisitions. He talks about everything. How does he finance it? How does he do it? And what are the plans for the future? This is my pod with Nick Keegan, the founder of Mail Metrics. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from my Connacht offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Connacht offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Connacht offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials for my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Connacht offices. Nick, welcome to the pod.
Thanks a million for having me. Delighted to be here.
It's a beautiful sunny Friday morning in Dublin, but it should be a beautiful sunny Friday morning in Spain for you.
Yes, it should be. Should be another holiday cancelled.
Oh, ouch.
Listen, you know, we get through it.
And you cancelled it just for the pod. I feel special.
Oh, yeah, just for you. Couldn't turn down this opportunity.
Welcome, man. I'm delighted to chat to you. A good friend, a good mutual friend of ours, referred you in. So I'm it was a pleasure to get to kind of know you and to kind of hear about your story. So yeah, Andy, thanks for the link.
Yes, Andy. Shout out to you. Thanks a million.
He's a great Andy Mackin. He's a great friend of the pod, a great friend of mine. So he's a cool guy. I love spending time with Andy. He's just one of the good people. Mm. How did you get to know him?
Through the EY Entrepreneur of the Year program. So I'm a finalist this year.
Congrats. That's big.
Thank you very much. Yeah. He's an alumni and we would have met in Singapore a couple of weeks ago. It's a tough life, you know what I mean?
Singapore a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, it is tough. Sounds hard. What was that trip like? Because I follow Andy on Insta and a few other people that were on it. I was like, it looked.
Yeah, like, it's as good as it looks, to be honest with you.
Don't tell us that, Nick. Just say it was all right. It looked amazing.
Yeah, like everybody tells you this is like the premier program and, you know, you'll have an amazing experience and so on and so forth. But you don't really get to appreciate it until you're there. You're flown out to Singapore, 23 other finalists, so 24 including myself, and probably I think there was 70 or so alumni from previous years. So it was a huge cohort, like 100 entrepreneurs, Irish entrepreneurs flying to Singapore, and it's just a jam-packed week full of content, speakers, sort of peer networking, good crack as well, you know,
like still, 100 of the best entrepreneurs in Ireland, like that's,
yeah, it's like a premium. It's such a massive like network. It's incredible.
How did you feel going out to it though? How did you feel initially when you're like, you got the tap going, you're in?
Delighted, excited. I think it's great. It's great just to be in the, like, it's kind of a cliche, but it's true. Like, you know, if you're in the top 24, you're already a winner. And when you go to Singapore or whatever the retreat is that year, like it's different every year, you can really feel that, you know. It doesn't really matter actually where you place. It's just been a part of that network. It's invaluable and it's something you can't buy. I heard someone say that previously, you can't buy it. Like, you know, you have to kind of get into it and earn your way into it. And it's just unreal, you know, just having a network of, you know, hundreds of other entrepreneurs that have been there and done it and gone through a similar experience or similar journey that I'm going through myself at the moment, it's unrivaled, let's say.
You do hear that a lot about, oh, you know, this is an experience money can't buy, but you paid $5,000 to go on holidays there, you know, and it's like, that's not really the point. The point is, earn it. You cannot just pay your money and turn up. There's very few things in the world now where you really can only earn your way in. I think there's a beauty and a power to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the experience and the show that they put on for you, like the EY team, just knock it out of the park. It's like a military operation, you know. So, yeah, just... and we're still in the thick of it. Like, the CEO retreat is completed now, but then there's now all the media stuff that comes up, and then the awards are in November, I think. So it's a whole year full of content and sort of events. And then once you're in the alumni. So next year, you know, the alumni are part of all the next events and so on. So
it's a great way of doing it. I always look at it and go, that's just well designed. You kind of look at it and you're like, that just seems like it's just beautifully put together, well done. And like, I love that alumni idea of like building on. You're building this network every year. Yeah. There's another cohort coming through, and the network's getting stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah, it's very active as well. You can see that. Like, it's I think the people who get most from it are the ones that engage with the network and stick around and come back the next year.
Yeah.
Sort of engage in
the, it's like anything, you put, get in what you put out, right? Absolutely. If you just turn up, sit there, don't engage, no, that was useless. It's like when people go to conferences and you're like, oh, was any good? And they're like, no, it was useless. And they're like, oh, did you meet anyone? Did you do anything? I just went to a few talks. And you're like, well, what do you expect? You know? Yeah. How did you end up there? What were you there for? How did you end up getting the nod for EY Finalist of the Year?
So I'm CEO and founder of a company called Mail Metrics. So we help highly regulated financial services companies, so banks, insurance, pensions, to digitally transform how they communicate and engage with their customers. So if you think of the household names, banks, insurance companies, pensions, providers, a lot of these companies have been around for decades, and they often have old legacy mainframe systems potentially, and their primary means of communicating with their customers is often printing them a mail and them a letter. And then you compare that to a new challenger bank or a fintech that provides a really slick digital experience. We help those more traditional financial services companies to provide the same kind of slick digital customer experience that you would expect from a fintech without the need for them to change out their legacy systems or anything like that.
Okay, makes sense.
So that's what we do, yeah.
How did you come up with that idea? Because that is not it's not one of those new sexy ideas. You know, you hear it on Dragon's Den, you're like, oh my God, yeah. This is one of those going, makes sense, but I don't even know how you'd even start to come up with an idea like that.
Well, we came about at we took the scenic route, let's say. So I started the company when I was 24, coming out of college. So my first real job. But the idea initially was quite different. So we had an idea for an app for consumers to help you manage your online bills and your statements. So instead of having to log into all your different service providers' online accounts, remember all your different usernames and passwords, have to reset them every time you want to log in, we thought we'd get one secure app on your phone and all your service providers could plug into the back end of that and push your correspondence and your bills and statements, etc., to that. And so Green Letter Box was the name of the business. And we raised $700,000 pre-revenue to get that off the ground.
Oof, chunky.
Yeah, we tried to raise a million just because it was a nice round number. We probably raised, to one extent, I think we probably raised too much. But on the flip side, then, that's probably the thing that kept us alive when the first plan didn't go to plan. So anyway, we raised $700,000 pre-revenue for that. And
what year is that?
2013.
Okay.
Well, we started it in 2013. I think we actually raised in 2014. So we probably spent the guts of 2 years trying to raise that money.
Right.
Which was a mistake. Like, we should have spent that time trying to find a customer, I think, would be the way I'd do it now. But hindsight is 2020. So we raised that money, thought it was such a transformational idea that we didn't even speak to any customers about it. Top tip, don't do that. So we built it, launched it to great fanfare. And when we started pitching this to customers, they were pretty quickly saying, well, no, I don't want my customers going to your app. I want them going to my website where I can sell them home insurance if they have car insurance or, you know, whatever.
So they want to keep that relationship direct. Keep that relationship. Customer.
And particularly, I think, in like financial services and even utilities and these kind of areas, they had other consolidator players, which they might not have been happy with these comparison sites and stuff like that. And so they didn't like the whole like consolidation idea.
Okay.
And I remember like when we launched it, it was almost like a two-sided marketplace to a certain extent. You needed senders to get on board and you needed receivers. So you needed the people generating the bills and the documents of your insurance companies, your utilities, your telcos. We needed them on board to provide content. Mm. And then we needed users. So the users wouldn't sign up without knowing what service providers were on. Providers would say, all right, well, this is intriguing, so we'll meet you, but how many users have you got? And you'd say, like, well, zero at the moment, you know.
So we're offering you nothing and we're offering you nothing.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out why we're not making any money. And so I remember the day we launched, we were expecting a tsunami of registrations, you know what I mean? And we built this. I said, I need an email notification to come out to me every morning with a list of all the subscribers, you know? So we launched, and the first morning was like, no email came in today.
We've got a fault, lads. I didn't get the email with the 10,000 number.
We're trying to figure out what the bug is in the email notification, but nobody signed up. So over time, we got a few thousand people sign up, but yeah, like, you know, that kind of two-sided business model is difficult in the best of times. But it was flawed. Like, it was flawed from the start. We were solving a consumer problem, and the service providers were the one with the leverage. We needed to actually get, they were going to be our customer, whereas the consumers were going to be our users, you know?
Leverage is the key, isn't it? Who's got the biggest pain and the biggest leverage?
Exactly, exactly. And so we were 3 years doing that, never got a customer really. Like, we didn't, it was horrible, to be honest with you.
That's a long time. How did you, first of all, I suppose, tell me when you knew it wasn't working in your heart?
It could have been 6 months after, like, talking to the first customer. Because, you know, you get a no when people say, oh, you'll get lots of no's before you get a yes. But then, like,
and it's true.
You've nearly spoken to everybody and they're all saying, no, you need to start, like, maybe reassessing what you're doing.
Okay.
And then we couldn't agree amongst ourselves. Like, I don't know if it was me that first raised the concern. Maybe this isn't a good idea. Like, you know, maybe this isn't going to work. And then I was like, yeah, I've been thinking the same. And others like, no, we just need to keep pushing on. I have two co-founders, Martin and Pavel Jarnas, two brothers. They're the technical guys. And so we'd be like, is this going anywhere or not? I don't know. And so eventually we realized this was a non-runner, right? So we had to, like, right-size the team to let everybody go. We had kept one developer, I think it was, and then myself and my two co-founders.
So this is 3 years.
Yeah.
Have you burned through all the wage at this stage?
Yeah, most of it. And we were getting to the point where we were going to run out of money. And I think, I'm trying to think back now, because it was like 9 or 10 years ago. But we got Enterprise Ireland, so the HPSU funding. And I think they tranche it, like they give you half of it at the start, and then based on certain milestones, you'll get another 125 grand or something like that. And we wouldn't get the second tranche, I think, if we didn't deliver on certain revenue goals or didn't show traction some way.
Mm.
So we were running out of cash. We needed to access this money, couldn't get access to it. And then maybe late in the third year or early in the fourth year or something like that, we got a phone call from a financial services company that said, lads, you were in here maybe a year ago selling some digital communication app or something like that. We have a tender that we're going to be issuing. We have a mail room where we print and mail millions of letters to our policyholders or our customers every year. That's our only means of communicating with our customers. We want to get rid of that and we want to try to move it all online. Is that what you do? I was like, absolutely, that's what we do. You know, that's exactly what we do. And so we said, we're going to go after that. And we spent 6 weeks or whatever it was, just 100% focus on this tender. And we built a product around that customer need.
You're essentially starting again, really, aren't you?
Yeah, same limited company, but we were starting. Now, it was kind of to some extent adjacent to what we were doing, you know what I mean? But we were starting again. It was a fresh idea. And that was a big success. It worked. We got, and these are pretty big contracts, right? So, you know, if you win one contract, you're getting a lot of annual recurring revenue. And so that got us to the point where I think we could then get the second tranche of VI funding.
Right.
And we were still burning cash, but like not much. Like we were still loss making, but we weren't hemorrhaging money. So we delivered that, and we basically built them a product where we could take a data feed from their mainframe system, where it's their essential, the core of their business, take a data feed, which creates these documents that they need to send to their customers if you buy insurance or if you, you know, renew your insurance, and distribute them out to their policyholders through various different channels. So you can still mail a letter if that's what a certain customer wants. We can send that by secure email. We can push it to a customer portal where they can log in and view it. You can upload your documents online. All of this kind of digital interface to manage your policy, let's say. So that's what we built for now. It was very basic initially, right? But that was the concept behind it. And we also added in a layer whereby we learned what all of the financial regulations stated. So if you buy a policy, you need to get your new business or your inception pack within so many days. That's a regulation, the Consumer Protection Code here, similar in other jurisdictions. If you're going to renew your insurance, they need to notify you so many days in advance that your insurance is up for renewal. This is what it was last year. This is what it's going to be. And so we built tools to allow them to report and demonstrate their compliance with these regulations.
Okay. Okay. It has a lot to it, isn't it, when you start breaking it down?
Yeah. So it's, so we helped them to cut massive amount of cost out of their business, provide a much better customer experience, and give customers a choice how they engaged with this company. And then equally prove regulatory compliance. You know, when we brought those three together, it was kind of a powerful thing. So then you have one customer as a case study, and then we went on to the next, and we kind of grew from there. We grew organically from there, yeah. Yeah.
How did you personally keep going during those 3 years? Because it's a bloody long time to be getting no's. Yeah, you do need to get a lot of no's, but how did you personally keep yourself motivated?
Wasn't easy, to be honest with you, because, you know, imagine being 2 years in, 3 years in, and you're coming, sitting in an office. Like, my co-founders are based out in Poland. So they were living in Ireland, but they moved back to Poland to set up the dev team. So you have the two lads out there, and at the time, our one developer sitting with them in a small little office. And I'm sitting over here on my own in an office. No emails coming in, you know, you've no customers, like, so you've nothing to do really on a daily basis. So you're, you know, trying to talk to investors, but like, you know, you've nothing to show investors. And so it's horrible. But I don't know, like, there wasn't, I was 24, 25, 26 at the time, didn't have a huge amount of other options really. And we had cash in the bank. And so you're saying, right, I might as well just keep flogging away at this.
Right, so the raise kind of kept you going, you could still afford to live and things like that.
That's, no, we were kind of taking like a measly amount out of the business, all three of us. Like very, very low, because we were burning cash, you know. So every penny we took out, we could see it depleting out of the bank. And it's kind of...
Do you think having a co-founder has helped you keep going?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I probably would have gave up a long time ago if I was on my own. Because you can bounce ideas off each other, and you say, well, why don't we try this, and what if we like reposition ourselves like this, and like, and you're just trying all these things. Yeah. None of them worked actually, right? But it doesn't matter, like, you have a team there with you that you can leverage, you know what I mean?
When you got the first customer, when did you think it was starting to work? When did you kind of go, oh, I think we actually might have finally cracked it here?
When we got the nod that we'd won the tender, I couldn't believe it, to be honest with you. I was like, geez, this is mad. And then when we actually, but then you're like, right, we need to deliver this now. So then that was in maybe 6 months. And then after the 6 months, it was working, kind of moved to business as usual. And you're like, all right, okay, this is working. Customers happy, quarterly reviews, they're happy. That's when I was thinking, maybe other companies have the same problem, you know? and you go and talk to somebody else and you're just explaining, actually, this is what we did during this project. This is the problems that we solve. And they're saying, oh, that resonates with us. Mm. And it's very different when you're going and you're pitching to somebody like the first concept and they're all like, that makes no sense. And they're picking holes in it all the time. And you're, it's like you're firefighting the whole time, trying to justify why it's a good idea versus going in and saying, but this is what we did for this customer and this is the value it brought to them. And they're saying, oh, that was a nightmare for us, you know. And so then you're like, right, it's so much easier. You can go into these meetings and you're looking forward to going into them and you're, you know what I mean? You're not justifying yourself the whole
time. Well, you had done the classic entrepreneurial thing. Every single one of us has done this. Created a solution. Now I must go find a problem.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I would never, and to this day, we'd never build a new module of our software. We don't release any products unless we have somebody that's waiting to pay for it at the end. Like we don't, we will always either listen to a customer need and say, oh, there could be a product or a solution there and build something for them, you know, or somebody will come to us and say, will you work on this? And if we think it could be useful for our other customers, we'll develop, but we don't really do things on spec anymore.
But for entrepreneurs listening, like if they take nothing away from this whole episode, that lesson is just, it's probably one of the most important lessons you'll ever learn as an entrepreneur. And weirdly, you nearly have to do it. People can tell, you can tell them, they can look at you, go, hey, why the year? Oh yeah, he said this. And this will go off and have this brand new revolutionary idea. No one's ever thought of this. It's weird. No one's ever thought of this idea.
Red flag.
Yeah. Massive red flag, right? This is the number one that you're like, but it's weird. It's one of those things that almost like a blind spot for entrepreneurs that, and you have to have that kind of blind belief.
This is going to be different.
Because otherwise you wouldn't keep going for 3 years.
Until it gets knocked out of you.
Yeah.
But it was like, I don't know who said it, but like life is too short to build software nobody wants, you know.
And it's one of the great Stoic philosophers that said, it might have been Seneca or Marcus Aurelius, I think, said that.
Exactly. Yeah,
don't build SaaS no one wants.
It's just, you know, it's, so as I said earlier, I think if I had have spent the first 2 years instead of doing all the dog and pony show, trying to raise £1 million, because that'd be a like great raise, you know, to raise £1 million, just arbitrary number to a certain extent. If we had a went out and spoke to these customers and said, this is what we're thinking of doing, we probably would have got to year four a lot earlier. Could have raised a lot less, given away a lot less equity.
Why is that, Nick? Why is there such an obsession with raising? Why is there such this fetish of like, it's almost seen as success in itself?
I don't know. Like, I wasn't in the startup scene at all. So I had this idea. We said, well, let's give this a go. And so then you're like, well, how do we start this? And says, well, you need to go and raise venture capital. What's that like? And you go, and so you see then all these startups, they raise £1 million, they raise whatever it is. And initially, I almost saw that as a sign of success. Like, yeah, the bigger the round we raise, the more successful this idea is, you know, it's validation.
I think, but that's actually, it.
Now I'd be trying to raise the smallest round I could that would still get me to the point I needed to get, you know, and ideally I wouldn't raise any equity if I could. If I could find a business, like with my business model that I have today, by taking out very small money or by winning my first customer or trying to find an early adopter that would work with me to develop this product in conjunction with them, we could have, you know, bootstrapped this totally. And like, we gave away a lot of equity at the start. And over the years, we've clawed it back, you know. But you're just giving away equity like confetti because you've no reference point. You don't actually realize that equity is going to be what's the valuable piece, not the salary that you might take. You know, this equity is actually what's going to be valuable.
It goes back to the leverage piece you talked about. You've no leverage at the start, zero. You know, customers.
No track record.
I think you've nailed it there. I think entrepreneurs and the startup community maybe as a whole, they, instead of seeking validation from customers, they seek it through raises.
And there's
almost an industry behind it now. There's almost this kind of industry. Oh, look, they're in the Irish Times. They raised £2 million.
Yeah.
You know, you don't write into the Irish Times go, we just got debt of £2 million. Great news.
Mm. Yeah.
You don't do that. Like, it's just not done. It's weird. It's a weird mindset.
It is weird. But look, that's experience. Like, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So you kind of follow what you see as the well-trodden path. And
that's why I love talking to people like you, though. Yeah. That's why I like breaking these down, because otherwise that's going to be always the path. And look, it's different for everybody. Yeah. That's the key thing. Sometimes you have to raise. Sometimes there's no other way, but sometimes there isn't. It's just a really, it's personal.
Yeah. Like, we, since that 700 grand, or whatever it is, around 700 grand seed fund that we took, like, we've taken on no equity since then. So, because initially after that, like, the business had underperformed for a long time. And, you know, it wasn't a very rosy story to go to. So we didn't even bother trying to talk to investors. So you had to figure out how to bootstrap it. And every penny we made in profit, we reinvested in. You win another customer, you reinvested, you hire another developer, you so on and so forth. And then actually, I realized that, you know, I don't need to raise equity. Like, we may raise equity now in the future because we really want to sort of go for broke and, you know, really scale it up. But it's not a requirement. So, yeah.
You've always done two companies there. You've done, like, a company within a company. And this is the big one, I think, for any entrepreneurs listening. It's never linear. Mm. And, you know, if you're waiting for the moment where you're like, oh, the stars have aligned, I've got the perfect idea, you're going to be waiting a long time. I'd say 95% of the entrepreneurs I've ever spoken to over the last four and a half, five years, it's nearly always been, yeah, we started, fucking made a balls of it, made a balls of it again, made a balls of it again. And on the fourth time,
yeah,
there was this customer, or there was this break, or we gotten from the right person, or we met this person at a restaurant, or we're at an event,
yeah,
and off we go. You know, but you have to start. That's the one message I try to get out in the pod all the time. You have to start.
Yeah.
And you have to make balls of it. And you have to put yourself out there and expose yourself and go, this is what we're gonna try build. Any good?
Yeah, I think resilience is a word that, like, comes to mind. If I knew before I started how terrible it was going to be at the start, you wouldn't do it, you know? So, like, ignorance is bliss to a certain extent. So you just need to start and get out and start talking to people. And I think the sooner you start talking to potential customers, the easier the process will be, you know? But yeah, it's definitely not linear.
There's a fear built up, I think, the fear of no. I think it's the fear of someone telling you, going, that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, but I'd rather get that on month one than 4 years later and realize you've wasted 4 years of your life.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say wasted, right? Because you learn a lot, but, you know, you get to the no a lot quicker and iterate quicker. And
temporary pain, long-term gain. Yeah, That's the thing you need to think about. Or it's going to sting
and
like hell.
It's not rejection, it's feedback, really. You know, if you take it as that mindset.
Reframe. Yeah, reframe it as.
That's a terrible idea, but why is it a terrible idea? And you drill down to try and find the nugget. And if there's not, there's not, right? And there mightn't be a business model there. Like, that's fine. But at least you know that before you...
And you're in the general ballpark. You're in the game.
Yeah.
You're in the game then. Been in the game is it.
Exactly.
Playing the game, been in the game. Because once you're in the game, you're learning. And, like you said.
Know, like, you kind of make your own luck to a certain extent. And the luckiest people are often the ones that work in the hardest.
Well, you wouldn't have got that call.
Well, that's,
you know,
what I mean.
No one's going to call you in your bedroom going, Nick, would you be interested in building this SaaS business? Like, no, that's never coming.
Yeah, exactly. But it's, you're out there, you're talking to people, you're putting your name out there, and eventually you'll find a thread that you can pull on, you know.
Because most people will quit. Most people will jack it in. They'll jack it in after 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. Nah.
Do you know what I think, though? Like, people say that to me a lot. But if you are coming from a background where you've had a successful corporate career and you had another option where you'd say, right, I could go back to that. Maybe I might have done that.
Mm.
But this was my first gig, really. So, like, didn't have a huge amount of other options.
That's through the wall or nothing.
I could have done something else. Listen, and I believe, I back myself that I could have went and figured out something else, right? But, like, you've started this project. You almost don't want to accept defeat either.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, on your first one, you want to make it a success. So there's a bit of resilience there just to keep going, I think.
And what was, because you've had an explosive kind of last 3-4 years, like you've really shot upwards in the last 3-4 years. So you kind of had the initial kind of three. What was kind of the following kind of 3 to 6 years, 3 years, say, after that? Was it like, oh, we're off to the races now, we've fucking cracked it, or what was it?
No, we hadn't cracked it. We knew we had a product that added value. Customers really liked it. When we got a customer, they were very happy.
Mm.
We were growing about 40 to 50% a year organically.
It's chunky.
Yeah, it was all right. But we knew there was such a big opportunity for us. But our challenge was our customers are highly regulated. They're big financial services companies. They don't move quickly, right? So if I meet you today, you're a potential customer. It could be 24 months, could be 36 months from first meeting you to convincing you that this is the way you need to go, and then them going through all of their compliance and procurement and all of this stuff.
That is actually a mental sales cycle.
Yeah.
But 2-3 years to get a customer.
Yes, but then they're exceptionally sticky, right? For the same reason. They don't change. So we just couldn't get enough customers. Like, we had a pipeline, right? We were talking to a lot of customers, but we couldn't progress them through the pipeline quick enough. And our model worked in the way that we put our digital platform in place. We would do all the digital comms. But there's a certain cohort of people who still want to get a letter in the post. That's how they want to communicate with their service provider. So we had a partner that would send those letters for us. And we realized actually that they had all of the customers that we wanted access to.
The partner did,
yeah, because they were printing a mail and letters for all of these financial services companies. And by virtue of the fact that they're printing a whole load of letters means they're probably a good customer for us because they haven't gone on this massive digitization journey yet. And so, like, couldn't see the wood for the trees for a long time, you know. We were a software business. And
yeah, just wanted you're to digital. Yeah.
But actually, we realized actually we should just buy this company because the way it would go, we'd go and pitch to a pension company and we'd convince them that this is the product they need to use and they'd go for it. And we'd manage the project, we'd manage the customer, we'd onboard them, we'd do the whole transition. And there'd still be a lot of documents that need to be printed and we'd give them to our partner. So their business was growing on the back of, let's say, our product, and they were getting value out of that. But we wanted access to their other customers. But if they gave us access to their other customers, it would cannibalize their volume. And it was just kind of, it was, you know, there wasn't alignment there necessarily.
It was good for them, not good for you.
Yeah, like it was good for us in terms of we had a good partner and they'd help us if we brought a contract to them, but it didn't help us to get more customers.
It was all upside for them.
Yeah.
You're just bringing new business, exactly. And they need you. The leverage comes
the project,
back to leverage again.
The customer and all of
they'd leverage on you. You yeah. needed them to send the letters.
Yeah, so we decided to buy that business. And the other key thing that I didn't mention, the financial regulators have this concept. I think it's like a material outsource. It's essentially if you're a financial services company and a part of your business is material to how you service your customers, if you're going to outsource that function to a third party, there's this whole regulatory approval process you need to go through. So they want to know, who are these guys? Are they going to be here next week? How do we know the data is safe? It's like a consumer protection type thing.
Yeah.
That's in Ireland, and it's other countries have very similar things. But they need to go through that process as well if they want to give someone the printing and mailing of their letters, because this is their most sensitive information. It's your bank statement,
yeah.
It's your health insurance correspondence. So they had already gone through all of those hoops. So we decided to buy that company. They're based in Dublin. And then actually, you know, because you're trying to talk to a number of companies and hoping that one of them will agree to an acquisition. So we found another company in the UK and we said, well, we'll get them both under heads of terms, and we got heads of terms out to both of them, and then some one of them will fall off, and so they both progressed, and actually we ended up acquiring both of those businesses, one in July 21 and the other one in August 21, so a month after
yeah. So you were kind of, there was plan A and plan B, and then you end up doing both plans
pretty much. Yeah.
How do you even start to buy a company though? Because, you know, you hear about this all the time. Oh, so-and-so has acquired so-and-so. And you're like, how does that even start? Like, Google. How do you even, like...
Google is your friend. But, you could, like, I didn't have a rasher, so how to, like, I wasn't up on the financial side. Wasn't my thing. We were just focused on winning new business, getting customers. You know, I could reconcile a bank. That was about it. So you go to Google how to buy a business, and you get these kind of generic responses, and how is a business valued? Like, what offer am I going to make well, it's valued on a multiple of EBITDA. It's like, don't have a clue what EBITDA is, and you're Googling it, you know, and you get the definition. It's like, I don't understand it. Now that you've got I still don't understand it. So I was going to do a corporate finance course online, like a 4-week course. And I was like, oh, I don't have time to sit there for a full week, do a 4 weeks, do a corporate finance course. So probably the best €120 I ever spent was, I went online and there's a website like grinds.ie or something like that. And I started approaching people who'd give accountancy grinds. And most of them said, like, absolutely not. Like, that's not what we do. You know, we train kids to do the Leaving Cert or college exams.
That's so the best story I've ever heard. Just went to, like, some teacher and was like, here, teach me how to buy a business.
Yeah, so actually what I did is I took my accounts, printed off my accounts, printed off the accounts of the companies I was looking to buy, some competitors. And I went to his apartment in Sandyford for like 2 hours and explained to me what EBITDA was, like why it's important.
This is class. You know, this is a great story.
And I was like, well, this business is bigger than this business. So is the bigger business a better business? And he said, well, that's a lower gross margin. I was like, well, explain that to me and base the basics now, right? And but then you have enough information that when you're saying, you know, an EBITDA multiple or, you know, gross margin, you know what you're talking about. You have enough information not to feel like a spoofer.
Okay.
And then...
So you had gone to these companies, said, I'm interested in buying you.
Yes.
And they were like, maybe. And then you'd gone off and go, I'll be back in a jiffy. You go off and learn. And what do? You go back with them on an offer? You go, I'm going to offer you this much? Or how does it work?
So like, the first time we were probably talking to these companies for 6 months to a year, you know, like it was unnecessarily drawn out because I didn't have a clue what I was doing. Since brought on like a good CFO with corporate finance experience who's kind of helped in that space. But, you know, when I was first looking at this, I didn't know what I was doing. So I kind of approached the business and you're saying, you know, would you be interested in acquisition? This is the reason why we want to acquire. This is the strategy. And the partner we had, that was a different story, like, because, you know, we had a good working relationship. So then we were going around all the corporate finance houses around Dublin trying to get someone to help us to raise money. Like, do we raise it with equity? Can we do it with debt? Like, how do we fund this? How do we value it? All of this stuff. So it took me...
You went a long way in a short space of time. You went from getting grinds in your man's house to going, but it was to hire a corporate finance house.
From having the idea to actually closing on an acquisition, it was probably 2 years.
Right.
It's the first one.
Okay. But still, no, like, that's a lot to transition. Like, you really put yourself in hyper mode there going, okay, this is the route to acquisition. Put myself out on a limb here and buy a company. Like, it's ballsy, like.
Yeah. I had a bit of time to, because it was like, you know, let's say 2019, had the idea, oh, you know what, this is, I think, what we should be doing, to research and talking to people. You go to the kind of the big four and you're speaking to those guys about, like, is this something you could help me do? And they're like, that's too small. You know, you just pick it up and I had a bit of time to get comfortable with the idea.
Right.
So ultimately we make an offer, you give them a heads of terms document, which basically outlines the head terms, the key terms, you know, how you're going to value the business, what multiple you're going to offer, how much you're going to pay up front, what will be deferred, if anything, will the person stay on or go, like, you know, so on and so forth. And you get that in front of them. If they accept it, you move to diligence, you do the diligence, you go through all of the financials, commercial diligence, and then you sign a SPA document and you bought the business, basically. That's
simple.
That's how it goes.
You're a cool customer.
But you know, the thing is, like, we've good advice, good advisors.
All right.
So Shane, my CFO, came from Deloitte. He worked in corporate finance in Deloitte. So he'd been doing that. Like, that was his career.
Right.
So he came on and learned a lot from him. We had good advisors. So really what I do is I find the deals. I approach the owners. I build a relationship with them. We get them to the point where we have a heads of terms document in front of them. Once they sign that, it's kind of handed over to the professionals to, like, do all the diligence and stuff like that, you know.
So you close two in 2 months, like buses. One, wait for one for ages, and then you do two in 2 months.
One in Ireland, one in the UK, yeah.
That it's a lot. Like, I mean, you seem very methodical and rational, but like, how did you feel when you're like, okay, we've started this, like you've had a big journey there in what will be 10 years now, exactly. You know, first 3 years, you know, struggling to get it done. Next thing, get traction. Next thing, right, we're going to buy a company. Ooh, accidentally bought two, lads. Here we go. You
know, oops.
Oops. Went to the Aldi middle aisle, picked up two chainsaws by accident. Like, it's wild. Like, it's, and then you're cool telling me, you're very calm telling me, but like, how did you feel like, you know, June and July? What year was it?
21.
June, July 21. So in COVID as well, add a little bit more spice to the mix there.
Yeah, in the gaff at the kitchen table. It was, the scary bit was probably when you have the loan document. So we bought these companies, we used some leverage to buy the businesses. And you're going to sign this loan document. And because we were relatively, like, I suppose we were a risky enough bet because we were a relatively young business. We were sort of a recurring revenue SaaS company, didn't have a huge amount of profits necessarily. We were,
were you sizable at this stage? Had you like grown a lot at this stage?
We'd got product market fit, but we weren't a big business, you know. We had good customers, recurring revenue. We'd never lost a customer, all of that stuff. We had a lot of good positives going for us, but it definitely wasn't a banking case that a pillar bank would have looked at. So we took on what's known as alternative debt.
It's a very nice name for it.
Yeah, or venture debt, depending on who you ask. Very high interest debt. So it cost us about effectively 20% margin on the money. Now, don't get me wrong, right? Like, it was extremely high interest, and that's what made me a little bit nervous signing up. But we'd done all the models. We didn't just do this on a whim. Like, you know, we'd analysed it. And we couldn't have done these transactions without that money. And so, although it was high debt, they were getting paid for the risk profile, and they backed us when nobody else backed us. So I had a good experience with it all. We refinanced out within, I think, like a day of it going into the next year. And if it went to the next year, rates go up again or something like that, you know. So we refinanced out with Bank of Ireland then, just regular bank debt. But we had to. You're effectively putting it all on the line because they own everything and they get their money back, you know. But that was fair enough. Like, we went into that with our eyes open and we knew exactly what we were going for, and worked out well for us.
That was a do or die situation, right? This is all or nothing here.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have liked, like, it worked out well, but I'd say if it didn't go, like, if the acquisitions, the integration or whatever didn't go as planned, or if we had lost a load of customers after acquisition and...
Anything can happen, especially in COVID, though. You know, you're telling this very calmly now, yeah. But that was the middle of COVID. We didn't know what was happening. We thought the sky was falling.
Our business model is very resilient because we have these big financial services customers. It's not discretionary. They have a regulatory obligation to communicate with their customers. So when we're buying these companies, you're looking back, and there's generally no growth in these businesses that we're buying. And we, like, by introducing our technology, we grow. We grow the sales, but we can see consistency, and it's quite of. It's, you can get fairly comfortable with it. You know what I mean?
There's a lot of lessons here. There's a lot of lessons in picking your market. There's a lot of lessons in picking your customers.
Yeah.
You know, looking at what.
Bit of luck, though, as well. Like, I didn't sit down.
Definitely.
On a whiteboard.
No, but like, you've been very clever as to how, once you did get fit, you got to grit. What I'm trying to think of is, and what I'm trying to explain is that you got to the core of the issue very fast here. You understood what the benefits were of, because people think of traditional companies like these going slow, you know, old, you know, whereas you turned that into a strength. You were like, legacy, they've got tradition, you know, there's no growth, but they ain't going anywhere.
Absolutely.
And then you were able to use that certainty to take a pretty big risk that you de-risked by knowing the industry and knowing banks are going to bank. They need this, and legally they have to do this.
Yeah. And in fact, because of regulation, the amount of communications they're sending is only going up. You need to give more information, make sure the consumer is more protected, make sure they're you know, aware of the financial product that they're purchasing. That all plays into our favour, you know. So communications generally go up as opposed to down.
So did you even get to see the business in the UK before you bought it?
Like, it was right at the final, right at the very end, we were able to go and visit it. But the initial conversation, it was all done over Zoom or Teams or whatever it was at the time.
Is it weird? You just turn up and you're like, hi guys, I'm your new dad.
Like, for the acquired company, it can be scary, understandably. Like, who's your man? Who are these guys coming in? What are they going to do? What's their intentions? Are we all going to lose our jobs? But on the contrary, like, we generally buy these businesses and, you know, they start growing again. And not saying that none of them have growth, but it's not known to be a really fast growth part of, like, the industry, right? But we come in with a technology product and we're essentially transforming these businesses and they start to feel good about this. You know, they're getting more business in the pipeline, they're getting more high value contracts, and, you know, we're converting them from a service business into a technology business. So for them, it's, once they get over that initial fright of we've been acquired, it can generally things go well. And it's not for everybody, and some people will leave, you know. Like, one of the businesses we bought, we doubled EBITDA next year. The other business, I think the same, doubled revenues and EBITDA next year, like within 12 months or so. And that kind of growth, then some people don't like it, you know, and they're not made for a fast growth company where things are changing all the time and you need to be able to adjust. And, you know, but we've done it like this for the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, that's, we've always done it this way. Those toxic words that will kill a business quicker than anything.
So sometimes some people will move on, but generally speaking, like, 99% of the people have stayed long.
What did it do for you then as a business? Because you've suddenly gone one company, two companies, three companies, all merged into one. What did it do for you?
So what it gave us a pipeline of potential financial service customers. So we would onboard them all onto our software and we say, you're currently printing and mailing letters to your customers is your only communication channel. We'll now onboard you onto our software where you can still print and mail a letter, but you now have all these other digital offerings to give your customers.
Okay.
So you can send a secure email, you can give them a customer portal where they can log in and view a PDF of their document. They can upload their proof of no claims bonus through this portal. SMS notifications, you know, your direct debit bounced, all of these kind of simple but effective things it gives them, and they can then convert away from solely printing letters to.
So this is a massive customer acquisition piece for you.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is we buy these businesses and they don't convert or change overnight. They're still they're still oil tankers and they move fairly slowly, but we have, because they're so sticky, we've now got a backlog of customers who are contracted with us. All this kind of central bank approval and all that stuff is already, we've already gone through all that, so that's all sorted. And whilst they're in our pipeline and we're working on converting them and onboarding them to our software, they're paying us every month. Whereas these same companies were in our pipeline before the acquisition, but we were 3 years talking to them and we were not making any money off them. Whereas now they're our customer and we're having the same conversation, but they're paying us every month.
Man, this is smart strategy.
Yeah.
This is clever stuff. Like, you've really, that was a masterstroke. You've built a moat here a mile wide.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that one thing. Like, we tried loads and loads and loads over the years to, like, you know, get more sales in. You know, what can we do to kind of increase the demand, make them move quicker? And you just, it's like, you know,
you're trying to speed up time when time goes as
a minute's a minute, an hour's an hour.
Yeah.
It is what it is. And this was the strategy for us to acquire 30 customers overnight. Whereas if you won 2, 3, 4 customers a year, that'd be a knockout, a big, big insurance company. That'd be a knockout year, you know? So
that's a sensational strategy. Mm. So that must have massively bumped the business.
Massively, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So you get that revenue from the acquisition, but then you get the uplift as well. So you start to grow these businesses and you start to grow the customer accounts. So I think we were probably 20 people in 2020, and we would have finished 2022 like 110 people. probably do 150 people this year if we go on to plan, you know.
That's explosive.
Yeah, I think even between 2019 and between 2019 and 2020, like more than 20x'd.
Right? Have you got your head around that as a person, as a boss?
Listen, it's a better problem to have than having no customers, you know, so it wasn't too difficult to get your head around sales going through the roof. Like that's a nice problem to have. The problems come on the, so you'll win all the business, you'll get the customers, you'll onboard the customers. The problems come in the back end of trying to change an organization from 20 people where everybody is talking directly to everyone. Like we didn't even have a concept of functions in the business, right? Simple things like this is operations. This is what they're accountable for. This is sales. That's what you're accountable for. Finance, customer success. Didn't have any of that because it was such a small team.
Yeah.
We'd all just talk to one another and figure out what needed to be done. And then you get to the point where you've actually now got people in Dublin, people in Northern Ireland, people in Scotland, people in Poland. And you need to start growing up as a company and putting these structures in place. But I'd never worked in a corporate job. So you didn't even have that context. So you're trying to figure all that out. That was the harder part, you know. Like the sales is great, like you know, that's a good problem to have, but the actual infrastructure of the company, putting that in place, and then it's changing all the time because, you know, even like we grew in 2022, like we grew 40% again, but even without any acquisitions, you know, and so even without the acquisition, where we were 12 months ago is no longer fit for purpose, you know. So, yeah, but good problems to have. It's better having growing pains than dying pains, let's say.
I think it's the really good insight there, though, that, you know, that experience in the early years, yeah. You can clearly see from chatting to you, it's really shaped your journey and it's given you a mindset, really great mindset of, you know, this is a good problem.
Mm.
This is a great problem to have. 3 years sitting there, no email inbox zero.
Yeah.
You know, now you've like all these customers, but that strategy of acquiring is super. Is that something you want to continue down the line? Playbook now? Have you cracked it? Is this the playbook for Nick?
That's the strategy. Yeah. Yeah. So where we took 2022 to integrate the first two acquisitions and try to figure out a playbook blueprint for how we can acquire and integrate at scale. We're very naive going into the first two, simple things that you just don't think about, right? So we're trying to build out a framework. We're going to create a new function in the business, acquisition integration function, where we can buy these businesses and just, that's a key element of our growth strategy now. So we need to have people who are just thinking about that all day long and just working on that all day long. So yeah, we're busy out there, you know, trying to meet potential acquisitions.
And you're now straddling Ireland and the UK. The UK must be a monstrous opportunity.
It's more so outside of Ireland now, to be honest with you. So we're looking at the UK and further afield. Yeah. So we'll look at markets where we think there'll be a good use for our product. Generally, if there's a good amount of regulation there, large population, that's generally where it's a good model for us. So yeah, definitely we'll be looking to make more acquisitions in the future.
What success looks like for you personally?
I'm very goal orientated. So now the problem is the goals tend to move all the time, you know. Like I remember, I think in 2019, I found an old text message that I sent to somebody to say, if we deliver on this plan, like by such and such a year, like 2025, we could be at this point. And like, we're already there, you know. And if I had a thought back then, I would have got to that point. I would say, well, that's it, like done, success. And now you're here and you're not happy. So you're saying, well, we want to go 5x where we are today. So I'm quite goal orientated like that. But I just enjoy the process of, you know, building something and setting yourself an ambitious goal and reaching it and hopefully, you know, surpassing it.
You seem like you love it. You're very clear. You're very concise. You can see that you love it. How do you kind of like look after yourself within that process, not get lost within the swirl?
It can be, I do really enjoy what I do, but it can be very consuming at times. Like, you think about it a lot, it's on your mind.
Well, the holiday is a perfect example. I know I joked about it at the start, but
yeah,
you know, it's, that's serious too. Like, because that lack of downtime can be detrimental.
Yeah, like, I'm all right, actually. I think I deal with it fairly. I don't really get stressed out too much.
I'm kind of getting that vibe, right?
Yeah, fairly laid back. But, like, you think about it a lot, you know, you're thinking about it not at night. Sometimes, if it's like, if there's something you're trying to figure out, you wake up and so you first thing you think about in the morning. But I genuinely do enjoy what I do. I don't find it a chore. Like, if I was to exit this business, or if this business, you know, in the future, I'd start another business, like, and I'd probably do very similar thing again. I'd find a fragmented industry providing kind of business critical services, and I'd roll it up, and I'd find a way to deploy technology to move it from a service business to a tech enabled service business. I think it's a really good model. And so I would just do the same thing again, right? So, it doesn't really. Doesn't faze me so much, you know.
Mm. You've just given a playbook there that any entrepreneur listening should be looking at that.
Yeah,
that is because people struggle to, you've encapsulated it brilliantly there, because people struggle to actually define it down and go, this is where it is. I ask people all the time because people love hearing about new trends, new ideas. But that's,
you know, I think that's the problem sometimes, that like you don't have to create a new idea that nobody's thought of before.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually, you know, we were joking earlier on, like, red flag. If you have an idea that nobody's ever thought of before, maybe, or nobody's doing it, maybe there's a reason, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier if you can find an existing market where there are successful businesses serving happy customers, paying them money. At least you've got over the bit where you're thinking, is anybody going to pay for this? Well, somebody's already doing it, so how can you do it better? And I think for, you know, even for tech entrepreneurs that might be able to say, well, look, actually, we could just buy an existing business. We could buy an existing service business, for example, and figure out how to deploy a layer of technology to do it better, faster, more efficiently, create a moat, make it more sticky than all the other competitors are doing.
That's a big trend in the US, but it doesn't seem to be here. Why is that?
I don't know. There's a lot of people talking about this now, and it kind of resonates with me because it's kind of what we're doing. Mm. Like, there's a lot of people talking about it on Twitter. The great wealth transfer, all of these baby boomer generation that have created all these SMEs that are now coming to retirement age. And some of them may be seen as not sexy businesses, but they're cash cows in some cases.
There's a woman called Cody Sanchez. You've probably come across her.
Yeah.
She's built her own personal brand
around
buying up businesses. Nick Huber, another guy. A lot of people in the States doing it, just rolling up this company called Enduring Ventures.
Walker Dibble or Dibble, Buy Then Build is another good book.
Yes, exactly. Is it a cultural thing here? Is it that we're just not used to buying businesses? Or are we such a young country that we don't really have that legacy business built up yet? Or what is it?
I don't know. I think you'd be surprised how many entrepreneurs there are knocking around doing massive roll-ups, acquisition strategies. You know, I've met a huge amount of them, like really successful entrepreneurs that have figured out a model and they're scaling it through acquisition.
Right.
I think it's probably more prominent than you would think.
If they're not talking about it, it's mad profitable.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's
maybe,
why.
Maybe I shouldn't be talking about it. No, but all joking aside, I think, it's effectively the, like the private equity model, you know, which is massive in and of itself, but it's just doing it yourself, I suppose.
How do you look after yourself? I talked about your mind there. How do you look after yourself physically when you're doing this? Because I like to look at the business as three ways: the business, the body, and the brain.
Yeah.
So how do you look after your body then as an entrepreneur? Because that can be challenging as well when you're in such a busy industry like yourself. You're in grind mode. And I say this to people, you know, you have balance as an entrepreneur, and you have to balance the body, the brain, the business. Sometimes you're in grind mode. Sometimes you're in build mode. You're in build mode. But how are you looking after your body during that time?
If you had asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said, I don't at all. I've just recently started trying to get back into the gym and stuff like that because I missed the gym every day for 10 years there. So just getting back into that.
You feeling the benefit of it?
Yeah, even just for the headspace, getting out and doing something, just having the routine of it, prioritising it, making sure that you're trying to do it 3 times a week. But listen, I'm only starting back, but it's something I want to focus more on. Because generally, if you had asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said absolutely nothing. I don't do anything, you know.
Why do you think that was?
Listen, those excuses, like, you know, just busy, too busy, tired when I come home. Cop-out kind of excuses, you know. It's not a priority unless you prioritise it. And start getting older. And just say, like, if I don't do it now, you know, I'll go down a slippery slope.
Yeah, you can't get away with it as much. You're younger. Absolutely. Bags of energy. Buckets of energy. I find for me, if I don't do it, just my mental health suffers massively. And just everything suffers. I think it's a compounding effect. You're either making tiny wins or tiny losses every day.
Yeah.
And what are you stacking? You're stacking tiny wins because it's not this big thing, right? It's not like, oh, suddenly I'm going to start doing this, going to start eating more greens.
Yeah.
It's part of it, but it's the tiny wins. Mm. Stacking tiny wins. What does the next kind of 18 months look like for you? Where is Male Metrics going? First of all, got to wish you good luck for November for the EY Entrepreneur of the Year. But what does the rest of the kind of the next 1 to 2 years look like for you?
We are working on entering the States. So we are talking to first potential customers over there, potential acquisitions. We will, please God, close another acquisition in that timeline. We have big ambitions to kind of 5x the business from here over the next 2 years. So please God, that comes to pass. I think just doubling down, doing more of what we're doing, trying to kind of double down on the business plan, scale the business up, enter new markets. And then at that point, we'll sort of readjust and see where we go from there, you know.
Brilliant. I wouldn't bet against it. If it ain't broke, huh? Just keep cranking the handle. Exactly. We're going to do a quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur read?
I'm going to cheat and use 2.
Oh, even better.
Okay.
Bonus points for you.
I read, this is a very popular book, but I read The Lean Startup about 3 years in. If I had read that 3 years previously, just teach you things like validate your ideas before you build them. Build a minimum viable product before you go and develop all this functionality that's not needed. I just think it's a good frame of mind to be in if you're starting from scratch, particularly if it's your first go. As you get further along and you're trying to figure out how to put these structures in place, Traction by Gino Wickman.
Yes, I've actually heard about this. I read The Lean Startup. It is unreal. And it's actually one of those ones I actually must go back and read again. Yeah, but I've heard Traction is excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it documents the entrepreneurial operating system. It gives a framework to running an entrepreneurial business. So everything from setting up functions in your company, making sure that everybody has certain accountabilities that they're responsible for, annual planning, quarterly reviews, weekly check-in meetings, all of these things that are the basics, but you don't know unless someone tells you.
You don't know what you don't know. What's the one thing you spend money on in your personal life that either improves your life massively or helps you?
I'm a simple man. After a long week, I like a pint of Guinness and a bit of crack with the lads. That's it.
It's a good reason as any. I like that. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I'd lump it all into Bitcoin. Well, I'm not a total degenerate, so I'd probably pay off my mortgage. And then I'd lump the rest of it into Bitcoin.
I love that answer.
Yeah, I'm irresponsibly long on Bitcoin.
Ditto. Good man. I'm definitely long. I'm not. Maybe I'm irresponsible. I'm not sure. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I think a lot of cancelled holidays, missed events. I don't really see it as a sacrifice so much, but yeah, a lot of that over the years, big proposals due in, need to move the dates at all day. you know, can't go to that event, have to meet potential client, so on and so forth. But yeah. Look, it's juice is worth the squeeze, you know.
You've obviously got a patient support network, which is also very important. Didn't really talk about that, but absolutely, it's very, very important. Yeah, if you weren't an entrepreneur, what would you love to be doing?
If I wasn't an entrepreneur, I would probably be in the Defence Forces. I spent 11 years in the Reserve Defence Forces. I was an officer in the Army Reserve.
Oh, wow.
My plan was to join the Army until I had this idea, and I said I'd give this a crack, and then went down this road. So yeah, I'd probably be in the Defence Forces.
Was not expecting you to say that. I now see the Andy connection as well. I don't know, I wonder he loves you. If I was going to give you €1 million, but you can only invest in one person or one company, what would it be?
Most of Elon Musk's businesses, probably not Twitter, but certainly SpaceX, if it was possible to do so. Mm. Tesla, I think, despite his flaws, he's a visionary entrepreneur, and I'd be happy for him to be the custodian of my €1 million.
Great answer. I'm bullish as well. There's been a massive public backlash against him. Some of the stuff he did was pretty ridiculous, but I think I am long Tesla, long SpaceX, long him in general.
Yeah.
When you kind of like look back at what he's done,
it's incredible.
It's ridiculous, really. Yeah. What's one thing you believe that other people might find weird or strongly disagree with?
I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on here now, back to my Bitcoin thing. I think we're heading towards potentially a massive kind of sovereign debt crisis. Moving away from the gold standard and all the money printing that's gone on and all these kind of lax fiscal policies. I just think it's scary, and we don't want to end up in a kind of hyperinflation Weimar Republic type situation. And that's like seems to me to be inevitable unless something drastic changes. So I think that the whole financial system is based on this kind of fundamental rules that I think are broken.
I would agree with a lot of that. If you'd start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
As I mentioned a moment ago, I would do a roll up in a fragmented industry that is providing business critical services, and I'd develop a layer of technology into those businesses to do it better than anybody else.
Beautiful. I just kind of wanted to get the answer out of you again so I could clip it. If you had to make €100 tomorrow, what would you do? Can't be your business, can't be something you already have. You have to make €100 fresh tomorrow. How are you going to do it?
Oh, jeez, if you put me on the spot, I'd have to just find and flip things online.
That's what I would do as well. Done that when I was a young lad. Made me a lot of money when I was younger. What's your one final bit of advice to any entrepreneur listening?
I would say, get out of the building early and talk to people. Try to validate your idea before you spend a whole load of time working on it, and realize that most people don't have a rash of what they're doing half the time. And so you just need to get out and figure it out, and someone else can do it, you can do it.
Brilliant. Have 1% of rashers more than the guy beside you and you're going to make it.
It's compounding. It's time behind the wheel. So the more you do it, the better you get at it, the more confident you get, and just back yourself.
Time behind the wheel. Love that. Nick, where can people learn more about yourself and MailMetrics?
I'd say LinkedIn is the best place to get me if anybody wants to reach out.
And then the company, where can they reach and learn more about it?
MailMetrics.com.
Simple. Nick, a genuine pleasure. The value you've delivered over the last 60 minutes has been immeasurable. So thank you.
Good amount, guys. Appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Wherever you're listening, whether it's Spotify, YouTube or Apple, click that subscribe button, and I will see you back here next week for a brand new podcast.